Has Operation Summer Heat cooled down gun violence in Miami-Dade County? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. 4 months ago, Miami-Dade County Commissioner Keone McGee warned,
"Our intel has shown us that there will be a bloody summer."
The county launched an effort stepping up police presence, watching social media, and summer jobs for teenagers. Commissioner McGee will join us today. Plus, sugar growers sue over water in the Everglades, and Miami does not want a wall to keep out a rising Biscayne Bay. And later, booster vaccines, kids and COVID, horse medicine. We'll talk about the latest on the state of the virus in South Florida. It's all ahead with your phone calls and tweets here on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for listening to public radio and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson. 3 months ago, this is how we started this program. It was a deadly and violent Memorial Day weekend across Miami-Dade County. Families, neighbors, police all hope to quiet the gun violence in the weeks ahead. Beginning today, 17 strike teams will fan out across the county. More police patrols will be on the streets, and law enforcement will pay closer attention to social media in hopes of heading off violence before it spills out in real life. That was the beginning of Operation Summer Heat, a three-month strategy to reduce gun violence in Miami-Dade County. The effort followed a series of high-profile shootings and a warning delivered from the Miami-Dade County Commission dais by Commissioner Keone McGee.
Our intel has shown us that there will be a bloody summer as it relates to the retaliations that's about to happen. Mr. Chair, you are aware within the last 2 days, there has been 4 homicides within the area, and from the intel we're getting from the ground, they're anticipating more.
So what has happened this summer? Operation Summer Heat stepped up police patrols throughout Miami-Dade County, monitored social media, created summer job opportunities. What were the results? And perhaps most importantly, what's next? What has your experience been? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to share your perspective with us. You could also hit us up on social media. Find us at WLRN on Twitter. Well, that commissioner you just heard from the comments in May is with us here live on this September ahead of Labor Day. Commissioner McGee, welcome back to WLRN.
Thank you very much, and I greatly appreciate the services that you're providing to this community, and we desperately need it because we can always count on accurate information coming directly from you.
That's the only kind of information we know, Commissioner, and I appreciate that. Thank you. We're proud to be public radio here in South Florida. In May, you warned of that bloody summer. We just played that soundbite. Was it a bloody summer?
By all accounts, no. What we're seeing is there has been impact due to the our response from the commission, from the mayor's office, from the police department, from the community buy-in. As you mentioned earlier in the introduction, we have been able to combat those potential retaliations that had been planned. And based upon some of the programs we're seeing now and some of the responses to those programs, we've gotten ahead of this retaliatory position that many of these folk had planned on carrying out.
Commissioner, it can be sometimes difficult to point to something that did not happen, but it sounds like that's what you're alluding to. What can you share with us about perhaps retaliatory plans that you are aware of that were not carried out because of police action or monitoring?
Well, I think it's a combination of everything that came into effect here. Number one, it's I got to give a great shout out to the best police department in all of the world. That is the Miami-Dade Police Department. Secondly, it also had a lot to do with the mayor's peace and prosperity plan. Mm-hmm. Third of all, we actually looked at the safety net program that we implemented in the South Bay community. And fourth, we looked at the community. The community came together at this table of understanding and realized that at the end of the day, we have to fight this thing with all hands on deck. And what we found out is just as much as there are issues with individuals talking about the police department's inadequacies or the police department's over policing up communities, they also understood that safety is a must in order for any community to come out of something such as deadly gun violence. And so they all wrapped themselves around each other. It was like a big hug from the community thus far. And thus what we've seen is a reaction that says, at the end of the day, if you commit a crime, we're willing to provide the law enforcement with that information to help get you off the street so you don't harm another family.
We're going to speak with the director of the Miami-Dade Police Department. Director Freddie Ramirez is coming up in just a matter of moments, Commissioner McGee. But talking about that community involvement and that last statement that you made, that had been pointed to by police and still is pointed to by police by having witnesses who are uncomfortable or unwilling to speak with detectives. Did you see that change? Did you experience that materially change this summer?
It's getting to a point now where they're more comfortable with speaking with individuals who they can trust and who they believe in, right? They do understand that their lives are in danger. This is no theory. This is, in a practical sense, retaliation is real. So what I've been able to do, especially down in the South District, a place I was born and raised, mm-hmm. you know, whenever I put something on my social media or whenever I get the phone calls from the gang members or the former drug dealers or individuals who are looking to participate in gun violence, and they warn me or give me the intel, they'll say to me, hey, listen, I'm only doing this because we trust you. Can you let your law enforcement friends know this is about to happen? So what I've been able to do is be the conduit through it. And so thus far, I can tell you they're starting to see law enforcement not as an agency to run away from or not deal with, but they're starting to see law enforcement as a community partner, something we hadn't seen in a while due to historical participations between the two.
So they're not going directly necessarily to the police department in some instances, but going through their Miami-Dade County Commissioner.
Correct. And it's a great start. You're talking about someone who and myself, who grew up on the same streets that these individuals are having gun war on. And so when they see me as part of government, which mm-hmm. I am. And so they'll say to me, hey, listen, I don't want to get involved or have my name mentioned in a police report, or I don't want to be recorded or tracked, or I don't want anyone to see me talking to law enforcement, but get this message over to them. And we have a very receptive police department that allows for those type of communications to happen. And every time I call Director Ramirez or anyone on his staff, the great team, they quickly respond. And by doing that, it allows for those who are giving us the information to know that their concerns are being heard and actually dealt with.
Well, let's say hello to Director Ramirez, Freddie Ramirez, the Miami-Dade Police Department Director. Director, welcome back to WLRN. Thanks for carving out some time for us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Good afternoon, Commissioner.
Director Ramirez, have you gotten those messages from Commissioner McGee where he's passing along a neighborhood tip, for instance, to you?
Commissioner McGee is outstanding. He's a partner in keeping this community safe, without a doubt. Monday through Monday, he'll call no matter what time of the night, and he knows that I'm by the phone no matter what time of the night. Any piece of information that we get is critical, so that we could share it with our law enforcement partners, so we can triage a situation to avoid an act of violence. And it's been, even before summer heat, we were already having that dialogue when he took office, and we were able to build the foundation to move forward with this. And I so appreciate his support to my men and women in South District. And you know, the trees are bearing fruit right now, and our community is in a great place, and we plan to do this to be consistent with this and sustainable.
Yeah, I want to ask about the sustainability of this kind of program, this kind of strategy. The Operation Summer Heat, Director Ramirez, according to your own social media, more than 1,800 felony arrests, more than 700 guns confiscated. How does that compare to a usual three-month period in Miami-Dade County?
Oh, this is definitely a big uptick, and not so much the arrest. What impresses me is the firearms, because those are over 700 opportunities for those firearms to hurt a child or to hurt someone that are in the hands of people that shouldn't have those guns or commit criminal acts. And remember that this is a collaborative approach. It's just not the Miami-Dade Police Department. Right. This is all the police departments in Miami-Dade County, along with the community, bonding together to stop the gun violence so that we don't become like the other communities you see around this country, where there's distrust, where there's violence, there's just a lot of issues here. We can't, like the commissioner said, we bonded together, we hugged together, and we worked through our issues together. And our number one priority is to keep the community safe And yes, these numbers are a lot higher than you typically would see in a traditional three-month period. That's why I extended summer heat. The mayor was gracious enough to let me continue this through December because we want to make sure that as we move into the holiday season and now with school open, that we keep this tempo and keep and let everybody know we're not going to tolerate gun violence here.
One of those community voices is going to join our conversation here in a moment, Director and Commissioner. What led to these results, though, Director Ramirez? What part of the strategy can you point to that led to the results, for instance, of the 700 guns confiscated that perhaps otherwise may not have been found had it not been for some specific tools that the Operation Summer Heat program allowed?
Well, it's the resources that our mayor and our commissioners gave us to augment our patrols, to put more men and women on the street, and also, remember, our officers have been communicating with the community. We have the intel. This is a big county, 2.9 million yep. residents. And they knew where to go. We did everything strategic. This is not about arresting everybody and a dragnet. No, this is strategic. We're focusing on the small amount of people that are causing the most problems. We're keeping our community safe, high visibility, community programs. We're in the parks. We're with our kids. This is a multi-layered approach. It's not just the enforcement. It's the presence, the communication. And the reason all of this works is the trust that we've been building for years here in this community. And that's the fuel that helps this be successful. You know, this is not each. This is working together to keep us safe.
It is multi-agency, as you mentioned, the Miami-Dade Police Department, one of the many agencies, over a dozen agencies, law enforcement agencies and communities in Miami-Dade County participating in this operation. Will they be continuing in that participation as the operation continues through the end of the year?
Absolutely. And they're very thankful. We have weekly phone calls with our partners and we work together. It looks like for now, Memorial Day for the holidays, we'll have officers at the beach working together. This is a county response. This is a community response. Yeah. And we all have a stake in this. And the goal is to keep our children safe.
How do you centralize the intel that, for instance, Commissioner McGee may be sharing or may be receiving that he passes along to the county police, but there may be a local law enforcement agency that needs to hear it?
Or through our Homicide Bureau's task force, we have a Lieutenant Benny Solis, who's the conduit who coordinates all these initiatives. As we get that information, we farm it out to the appropriate municipalities through our real-time crime center, even FDLE, our federal partners, who've been also assisting. Any information that we get, no matter where it comes from, no matter how granular it may be, that's immediately processed and farmed out, because our goal is prevention, to interrupt this from happening, monitoring social media. You know, now we've just developed a cyber crimes unit that's assisting our homicide unit. You look, right now our clearance rate is over 60% in our homicide bureau. When we were around the 30%, struggling 30-32%, we're at a little over 60%. And that's an amazing... That to me shows that we're making a difference. That means that people are communicating. Our detectives are getting those opportunities to be able to bring closure to the families and bring these people to justice who are ruining families and lives.
Were there specific goals or internal ambitions that you had as you went through the summer months, Director Ramirez, in regards to the stepped up patrols and social media monitoring, for instance?
There were two goals. And the goal is that the gun violence would stop, that we would curb it. And the second goal was to make sure that we maintain our community relationships and that trust that we have, that we do our initiatives in a professional and safe manner. And that's what I'm so proud of the men and women, not only of the Miami-Dade Police Department, but of the entire law enforcement community here, that, you know, we're all focused and we all believe in the same thing, and that's safety. And it's not about the numbers. It's about the results.
Director Ramirez, stick with us. Director Freddie Ramirez, the head of the Miami-Dade County Police Department. Keona McGee is with us as well, the Miami-Dade County Commissioner representing District 9. Let's say hello to Lyle Muhammad, Executive Director of Circle of Brotherhood. Lyle, welcome back to WLRN. Thanks for your time.
Well, we thank you for allowing us the time, and peace and blessings to both Commissioner McGee and Director Ramirez as well, and your listening audience.
Yeah, and to one and all, absolutely. Right back at you, Lyle. Director Ramirez spoke about that goal of continuing and building trust and relationships with the community. How would you describe the impact of Operation Summer Heat?
Well, the very first thing I would say, it would be silly not to applaud any effort that has moved the needle towards saving and preserving life in the right direction. So I applaud that. However, I think we need to be aware of what I'll call it the dandelion effect. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've ever seen a lawn full of dandelions, if people have guests coming over or attention or a spotlight's been put on it, we clean it up and it looks like the lawn is clean, but yet that dandelion root is 2 feet deep. And so while we have, as we have in the past, we've come together, operations have been done and so forth, but we have not attacked the cultural mindset of violence that's necessary for us not to be in the same situation over and over again.
What's needed in that regard, Lyle, to build upon what Commissioner McGee and Director Ramirez see as the success of Summer Heat over the past 3 months?
A perfect example. We always talk about how policing is not the only answer. If we really look at it, though, the funding was made available for the policing effort to take place. And while, yes, funding was made available for our young people, particularly high school teenagers, to be employed and engaged this summer, and really that should be 100% every summer, to be quite honest, that should be mandatory in any budget. However, the types of programs and entities that actually tap into the root of changing community culture, being involved with the disparaging factors that lead toward the culture of violence. We're dealing with trauma care, and you're dealing with people who are in the community on an everyday basis going through transformational training. Until that takes place, we'll be back again having another press conference talking about we need to come together and get a hug when we really need a cultural lumbotomy.
Lyle Muhammad is the executive director of the Circle of Brotherhood. Lyle, you have an opportunity to speak directly to Commissioner Keone McGee and the director of the Miami-Dade Police Department, Freddie Ramirez, individuals that I'm sure you know about, certainly, and have spoken to in the past. What do you want them to know about treating the cause as you describe it and as you define it?
What I'd like, first of all, for Director Ramirez to know, who I have a great deal of respect for, is, number one, keep on doing what you're doing. He's doing what police are supposed to do. But I would ask for more advocacy when organizations like ours, for example, and our approach and our way are left out of these equations a lot of times, but yet people want to jump on the bandwagon when they see some success with that. So root for the other side as well to get the funding in the background. But Director Ramirez is doing an awesome job transforming the department inside and out. So he's doing his job. What I would say to my good brother, Commissioner McGee, is, you know, politics and violence has always been a temporary marriage. And I know politicians in many kind of ways, they're putting positions a lot of times where they, number one, they have to look good because the pressure's on. But we don't look at the long-term solution-oriented approach to ridding our community of violence, and we stay in these repetitive circles. So I ask that, for example, the new work model that we brought to Miami be looked at, and that we looked at some of those more intrinsic things. And let's just be realistic. Sweeping up a rug and making it look like it's clean doesn't mean that we're not going to be right back in the same situation again.
Commissioner McGee, I'd like you to address some of those concerns that Lyle mentions about going after those root causes, going after community trauma left over by gun violence. Director Ramirez and his women and men of law enforcement can take those guns off the street, but what about addressing those root causes?
Well, again, those root causes that he referenced to are not going to be dealt with overnight. And this is where he and I agree that we must start somewhere. And that somewhere is the first step was to remove the guns and get them out the way. Secondly, there has to be a long-term game plan. And I'm not talking about a one-year or two-year plan. And this is not going to be something that's going to be ended or uprooted by politicians or elected officials or policy. This is going to be something that's going to have to be done with the consent of the community, because until the community decides to change, it will. Third, if we're going to bring in more programs, which I believe we must guard against because we are stewards of the public purse as it relates to who we give the money to and how we give the money out to, I believe we must vet programs and look and see if they are able to produce what they say they can. You know, oftentimes emotions drive us to believe that we can do more than we claim that we can do more than what we're claiming. I don't want to have a conversation some 2-3 years down the road because we had a knee-jerk reaction. We need something to deal with the systemic issues that are found within all of our communities, and particularly those challenging communities, not just simply based on their race, but on the social economics. Mm-hmm. And social economics plays a huge role in changing the mindset, the cultural of these communities that have oftentimes been left out of the equation. And so advocacy is going to have to be one of the top priorities in getting those programs that have been vetted, that have shown that they can produce, and number three, that have shown that they can bring the change that the community desperately need. So I do not oppose anything that he's saying. As a matter of fact, he's my brother, and I love the work he does. And he knows I'm one of his biggest advocates, along with the organization advocating for them. But what I don't want to do is lose sight of the fact of the matter is we've taken over 700 guns off the streets. We've seen a decrease in the actual gun crimes on our streets. We're seeing more individuals participating within this culture where we're going to try to change it so that people can feel safe in their home. Then I think we first have to acknowledge that, yes, change has happened. And yes, we're going to need more and have that more optimistic approach and move this needle forward. But I'm very much aware and I'm very excited. As a matter of fact, I'm listening to my brother Lyles here talk about those programs and those issues that he raised. You know, I'm thinking, okay, now what else can we do? Because again, this is not going to be something that's driven by politicians or elected officials. This is going to be something that has to be driven by the people who it affects the most. And our job is to help them through the purse of the county and with the resources so that they can get to where they need to be.
Lyle, elected officials have political terms. Commissioner McGee has a specific term, for instance. Neighbors and communities don't. How can progress be made when you do have a political structure that does have budgetary powers, but yet also has an election calendar?
Well, sometimes we just have to be quite frank, you know, and I'm sitting here and I'm listening to our conversation. And I'm reflecting upon the fact that all of the years and all of the programming that we've ever done toward preventing and eradicating violence in Miami-Dade County, not one of our programs has ever been fully funded. Not one. So we can't ignore the elephant in the room. There is an imbalance in how we spend our money. And look what's going to happen. Those 1,400 arrests, what kind of transformation are they going to go through? And how many of them are going to end up recycling back out in the streets, either as better criminals because they never had the proper intervention that was needed, and then we'll have to take another 700 guns off the street again? I'm just saying we have to look more critical at where these imbalances are. And if the politicians aren't willing to either grow intellectually to see where that balance funding needs to go, or to properly vet organizations like ours rather than just lauding our work, and then actually get involved in finding the funding, then we are going to have to look elsewhere for funding, because it does take resources, and we can't do a job in our community if we're not fully equipped with the resources to do it.
Commissioner McGee, you've got tens of millions of dollars over the next many years, thanks to a naming rights deal for the facility that the Miami Heat play professional basketball in here in downtown Miami. That is to be earmarked for these types of programs.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because if you look at the safety net program that we've instituted down in the South Dade district, we have a wraparound approach. We've taken some of those resources already, and we've actually put them in places and organizations that have shown that they're able to carry out the mandate of the people. We've actually dealt with jobs. We're dealing with mental health issues. We're dealing with mentorship. We're dealing with the community beautification projects. We're dealing with making sure that a whole person, not just a half person, comes away from this particular experience. Let's be absolutely clear. This is a moment of truth where we can all say, listen, we don't have to point fingers one way or the other. I don't have to sit here and blame the police for not doing their job. I don't have to blame community leaders for not doing their jobs, or community activists for not doing their job, or commissioners for not doing their job. But what I can say is, as an optimistic approach, we must be honest with ourselves and say, this is not going to work well on a fair and balanced approach until we say we need each other in this process. The truth of the matter is, I've been in office less than a year. As the new elected commissioner down
in the commissioner, right before that, serving in the Florida State House.
And so what we're seeing now is
listen, the government closest to the people are the ones that people are looking to the most to say, okay, answer this issue. That's why it's so important to make sure that this balanced system that we're looking for has the right players in place to carry out the mission and the mandates. No longer just simply throwing money out there because we can, because the people are gonna hold us accountable to it. But if we wanna produce results that we've seen over the last 3 months and make those things consistent, we must now transform, like Brother Lyle's talked about, making sure that this is gonna be a long-term system that helps so we don't have to deal with this again.
So share with us, Commissioner, the prioritization that you're thinking about for these new dollars that are being earmarked for these kinds of programs that are to be coming into county coffers well beyond the expiration of your political service to the District 9 commissioner seat. And how are you looking at that via law enforcement dollars, dollars addressing youth employment, for instance, dollars reporting recidivism and trying to address recidivism of people who are arrested so that they don't turn back into the justice system?
Great question. And let me just say this to you. There are a percentage of individuals who are going to be arrested or who have been arrested. They don't deserve to be on our streets. These are the violent criminals. They don't have a place on our streets. They shouldn't, because these are the individuals have shown that they are not going to be rehabilitated no matter how much money we throw at them, right? But for the ones who have made a mistake before and found themselves on the other side of the law and they want that second chance, the monies that we are going to receive are going to go directly to help them and elevate them to a level where they envision themselves. Let's be absolutely clear. This entire nation, everybody in this nation, has received a second chance at life, whether it's because they were arrested, whether they were an alcoholic, whether it was an addiction, whether they were suicidal, or whether they just simply were homeless or something of that nature. But the truth of the matter is, these dollars are going to be used to help with second chances for these individuals. And how do you do that? You address the four core principles of the American experience. We talk about family, we talk about faith, we talk about flag, and we talk about freedom. Those are the four core principles of the American experience. And when you address family matters, like when individuals, when they need to go to a park and they can't afford the equipment in order to play a sport, it is incumbent upon us to find ways to make sure that there are programs in place to help them with things of that nature.
Commissioner,
when you look at the... Go ahead, sorry.
How best for people to access those kinds of resources?
Simple. Make sure they participate in the budgetary hearings that we normally have. Make sure they understand who their commissioners are. Make sure that they meet with their local elected officials at every step of the term. And make sure that they hold each and every last one of us accountable, from community activists to elected officials to police. Everybody is accountable, if you're in a public's eye, to the very people that actually elected us, the very people that pay their taxes to help us, and the very people who work so hard day in and day out to create a great economy and a great community.
Director Ramirez, I want to bring your voice back here as we close out this conversation. You mentioned that the Operation Summer Heat, summer may be going away by the way of the calendar, but the progress, or rather the program, is to continue. Is the strategy changing based upon what you and your officers have learned over the past 3 months? Is it expanding in some areas, contracting in others?
The strategy is the same, but I want to also thank our state attorney, Kathy Rundle, because she invested in this program by giving us additional attorneys that help prosecute these cases to bring closure to the families. I'd like to thank Tangela Sears, Romania Dukes, Leroy Jones, all of the, this is the small footprint of those in the community, our state attorney that are helping us. This is the template that I think that works for us. I had a meeting with the SAC of the DA who came to meet with me, and she says how nationally they're talking about this program, how the impact that we're making here in Miami-Dade County. She wants to be a part of it as well. I mean, to me, that shows that our community is in the forefront of safety, and we definitely have other issues that we have to work out. And you could count on the Miami-Dade Police Department to be a part of that to help keep our community safe.
What's the Labor Day weekend look like for you, Director?
Labor Day weekend, safety. We'll be in the waterways. We'll be with the traffic. Summer heat will be going. We'll have officers at the beach. We'll be receiving information from the community. We'll be mentoring our children. And we'll be vigilant. But also, to keep this community safe requires the community as well to play a big part. Those are our eyes and ears out there to give us that information, 305-471-TIPS. suspicious activity, anything you see, please let us know. Let your commissioner know, like Commissioner McGee, and we will take action and keep you safe.
Director Freddy Ramirez, the Miami-Dade County Police Director, thank you for your time. Commissioner Keone McGee, the Miami-Dade County Commissioner representing District 9. Commissioner McGee, nice to have you on the program as well. Lyle, thank you for sharing your perspective and important voice. Lyle Muhammad, the Executive Director of Circle of Brotherhood. To each of you, have a safe Labor Day weekend. Thanks for your time today.
Okay.
You as well. Thank you all.
Still to come on our program, the South Florida Roundup continues, a new fight over water in the Everglades, and how to hold back the big water of Biscayne Bay. That's still to come. Stick with us. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public media. A massive reservoir just south of Lake Okeechobee is intended to help revive marshes, but sugar growers in the state have filed a lawsuit to stop the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers from using it. We'll discuss the growers' concerns and what may lie ahead for the project in a few moments. But first, Miami-Dade County is working on making the county more resilient to storm surge and sea level rise. The county recently rejected a proposal by the Army Corps of Engineers that included the construction of a massive concrete wall along coastal areas. So what concerns do you have about flooding and the vulnerability of South Florida to rising seas and storm surge? How to go about protecting coastal areas, protecting inland areas, and of course, how to pay for it? Share your thoughts with us, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. WLRN environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich is with us here on the South Florida Roundup. So, Jenny, tell us about this Corps of Engineers idea to build a wall or series of walls in Biscayne Bay to help protect Miami-Dade County.
Right. So this was a plan that was expected to cost about $4.6 billion. It would have included flood gates across the Miami River, the Little River, and flood walls along Brickell Drive and other parts of the bay, would line the bay with these walls to stop the increasing impact from hurricanes and storm surge, which is getting worse because of sea level rise.
Describe the walls for us. We're all somewhat familiar with sea walls, but what are these kinds of walls like?
Well, these are walls. In some places, they would have been 20 foot tall. That's what they were proposing. And they would have been not sea walls. They would have been like literally in the bay and been there to block the storm surge flooding.
So the county officially said no thanks to the core idea of these walls. Why?
Well, they get a lot of criticism. There's a lot of concerns about the walls. The environmentalists were worried about the impacts that the gates and the walls would cause in Biscayne Bay. We've already lost acres and acres of seagrass. We're dealing with water quality problems. And also the downtown business owners did not like the idea of blocking the view.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some real potential real estate costs for blocking that view of 20 foot high walls.
Right.
So the plan that the Corps put in front of the county, the wall or walls got a lot of attention and for obvious reasons, but it included a lot more within the plan, raising up low-lying properties, flood-proofing buildings, even planting mangroves to help protect neighborhoods to break up storm surge. So is the whole plan thrown out?
No. So what the county is proposing is what they're calling their locally preferred alternative. So they can sort of cherry pick things that are in the core plan now, include those in their plans. Their emphasis is that they want more nature-based solutions, things like those mangroves. Mm. They could even try and create like an oyster reef. That's one of the proposals from Swire Properties laid out of an alternative plan that the county liked a lot. So they could hang on to those things. Where it gets complicated is that anything that the Corps approves has to pass muster with their cost benefit analysis. They call it a national economic development plan. And it's it's kind of a congressional order. Like mm-hmm. if you're going to spend federal taxpayer money on stuff, it better be a good investment. And this plan was going to be a 65-35 shared cost. So the county would pay a third of it and the feds would pay two thirds of it. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And going forward, though, it's not clear, what the Corps is going to sign off on and agree to cover the cost of.
What are the problems that the Corps plan or this locally advised cherry-picked plan. What are those problems that those plans are aiming to address?
Well, so the Corps was really targeting storm surge from hurricanes, the kind of chronic flooding that we see during a king tide or heavy rains. They say that's something that the local stormwater utility has to address. They're doing similar work in Monroe County, mm-hmm. and that's been one of the complaints is, you know, there's parts of Key Largo that flood all the time. Why isn't the Corps plan address that? And they say, well, no, you know, we're here to address the storm surge problem. The county has been working for a while, their resilience office, to come up with a number of ways to address the kind of chronic flooding. One of the complaints was that the two, you know, the county work and the Corps work weren't coordinated enough, and that the Corps needed to take a look at what the county was doing so it either didn't cancel out that county work or was better coordinated.
So we've got two essentially government agencies, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, an arm of the federal government, arguably, and the local county government in Miami-Dade County. Are they at odds here? Is that overstating the fact? I mean, what's the next step?
I think they're going to try and work together just because the county would like to see some of that federal money pay for these projects. but they do not like this hardened gray fortress-like infrastructure that would not be pretty around Biscayne Bay. But again, the Corps right now, the study cost $3 million and took 3 years. So before they even continue, they have to ask their higher ups to approve additional money and more time because they're going to have to reanalyze all these proposals. Another problem with the Corps plan is because it's such a huge, costly project, the work itself was, you know, over $4 billion. Mm-hmm. They only did 10% of the design work. So it was a pretty rough idea of what exactly they were going to build. And there were concerns that with that little known about what the actual design would be, we wouldn't know what the impacts were going to be. The critics wanted to redo the environmental analysis with more detail about the design. So the Corps is sort of right now in the middle of either asking for a waiver for that analysis or considering doing more design work, and that would have prolonged the schedule too. Because it was supposed to be done in time for a congressional authorization in 2022 is when the next Water Resources Development Act comes up.
Yeah. So in the next session of the U.S. Congress. Well, let's go from saltwater to freshwater here and talk about the Everglades. We're speaking with WLRN environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich. Lots to talk about with water this week. I mean, obviously, we've been dealing with the storms for one thing, but water is always a hot political, hot legal, and a hot environmental, even a cultural issue. For Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades, sugar growers are now suing, or rather again suing, over water. This is a new federal lawsuit. First of all, help us understand, what water are the sugar growers suing over?
So they are suing over Lake Okeechobee water. When comprehensive Everglades restoration was approved by Congress in 2000, they said, you know what, we are going to protect your water, sugar and utilities and the current, you know, the users then, to ensure that you continue to get your water as we move forward with Everglades restoration, which is basically moving a bunch more water south into these marshes that have dried out from flood control and Florida Bay, which is always vulnerable because of the lack of fresh water.
Is it is the water that they're suing over the water that's in the lake right now? Or is it just it's lake water that kind of flows down and moves into
so
that area?
It's it's so complicated. It is, the Corps right now is redoing its lake management plan. Right now, the lake is kept lower because there were problems with the Herbert Hoover Dyke, 80-year-old dike. Mm-hmm. It had needed tons of repairs after Katrina. They did a nationwide assessment and figured out that our dike was an imminent, you know, it could fail. It was in imminent danger of failure. So they've been doing that work. As they completed that work, they said, we're going to come up with a new management plan to take advantage of all these repairs. And that means we can raise the lake and we can increase the levels of the lake. So the lawsuit is, as that lake water is increased, there's new operating bands. They want to ensure that the water that's held in the lake at a new higher lake, that they hold on to the water they were promised.
And so where does this lawsuit travel next? What's the next flow for this? And who exactly are the sugar growers suing?
So the sugar growers are suing the Army Corps because they say they violated that promise to protect their water rights, that they also violated an environmental assessment that they were required to do as part of the reservoir project. You know, you have to look at impacts to the environment whenever the feds do work, they have to do that. So And I will say that they have pushed back hard on me because they say that they are not trying to stop work on the reservoir. That's what the sugar growers and statements they've sent to mm-hmm. me have said. However, the lawsuit, when you file a NEPA claim, and I have double checked
NEPA.
The Environmental Protection Act claim.
Okay.
Normally that is done because you think there is going to be danger to the environment. Those environmental assessments have to be done before work starts because you're supposed to gauge what the impact is going to be so that you avoid those impacts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is basically, the attorney I talked to today said, you know, it's you want to look before you leap, basically. Mm-hmm. And so in making that claim, they are saying the Corps failed to adequately assess the impact before they proceeded with this work. So it seems disingenuous to me to say we're not trying to stop the project when your complaint basically says the Corps failed to adequately analyze the potential damage. They also asked a judge to order the Corps not to use the reservoir or the stormwater treatment marshes that are attached to it until they comply with that assessment.
WLRN environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich with us. Jenny, thanks for sharing your reporting with us. Always appreciated.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Water runs through all of it here in South Florida. Still to come, the pandemic, COVID-19 in the South Florida community. What questions do you have? Vaccinations, boosters, horse medicine in the news around COVID-19. 800-743-9576. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. We've been dealing with the coronavirus pandemic for more than 18 months, and what we know about the virus continues to evolve and change as the virus also continues to evolve and change. Even with vaccines and antibody therapies being widely available, and what we've learned about slowing the spread of the virus, cases and hospitalizations due to the germ are high. So what questions do you have about the virus? Do you have questions about vaccines? What about booster shots, breakthrough cases, long-haul COVID, ways to protect yourself? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We welcome back Dr. Cheryl Holder, FIU Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine Associate Professor. Dr. Holder, welcome back to WLRN. Thanks again for your time today.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me again.
Always wonderful to speak with you for any purpose. Wish it was perhaps something better than COVID and the pandemic, but here we are, 18 months and counting, continuing on. We've got several questions from our audience. We've been asking them via social media, so we're going to hop right to it. Jill in Delray Beach wrote us that she is fully vaccinated but contracted the virus in July and had mild symptoms. She tested positive in 2 rapid tests and 2 PCR tests the following week. She says her primary doctor, who did not examine her, told her she will test positive for about 12 to 14 weeks. So she wants to know when she could get a negative test and when she could get a booster shot.
The negative tests, what we found with this Delta variant is that the viral particles last longer and they're present longer. We're not sure how much longer the infectious period may be, but we do see it longer. So people are testing longer, and depending on how sick, we say even stay away and after a serious illness for several weeks. So within a month, most people will show negative. Before you would see at least a week or two.
Yeah.
But if not, the key thing is that even though you're positive, you're not infectious.
So
that's the good news.
How long is one contagious after the first day, for instance, they test positive?
What we're seeing, it can be 12 to 14 days later. Depending on how sick you were, if you're in the ICU, we sometimes request that you expect to be stay in isolation, because the data is, you know, it's not clear enough to say absolutely everyone. But we're saying going up to 20, 30 days.
Wow.
But if you just had mild disease, within 14 days, we are able to go back out.
Now, we don't know. Sorry, go ahead, doctor. Okay.
And not be afraid that you're going to infect others.
Yeah. Jill, she also asked about a booster shot. We don't know how old Jill is. We've been waiting, expecting some kind of announcement out of the FDA or the CDC regarding booster shots. The White House certainly has been pushing hard for a booster shot announcement. What can you share with us today?
Yeah, the White House came out before the FDA and CDC, which was September 23rd. They're going to approve it. After an infection, we used to say up to 3 months, and that was a lot because of vaccine availability. Now we tell folks definitely after a month or so of your infection, you can start getting your booster vaccine.
Okay.
But definitely within 3 months, you can get a booster. The FDA, CDC have not approved the booster, but we anticipate it will happen by September 23rd, as the president said.
So that's the time frame if you've been infected. If you haven't been infected, are we still expecting 8 months after your second shot if you got the two-dose regime?
Absolutely.
Okay.
8 months if you're well. If you're immunocompromised and transplant patients, they will, speaking with your doctor, after 6 months, many are getting the boosters.
John in Atlantis is joining us here with Dr. Cheryl Holder from FIU. John, you're on the radio. Go ahead. John, I think you're in your car there. Hopefully your seatbelt is on if you're about to drive. Can you hear us, John?
I am.
Okay, go ahead, sir. You're on the radio.
Hi. So my question is really more about the fact that you get these answers from medical professionals, we don't know yet. We don't know enough. And in my case, I'm actually taking my 20-year-old, who is considered at this point a long hauler. She went through many medical procedures and near-death experience. And nonetheless, we're about to get her vaccinated. And I got to tell you, we're still nervous Nellies, considering that everyone's got a different approach and no one's really got that. Most of the people are about getting vaccinated because it's better protection. But, because of a myocarditis and the constant reply of we don't know is very discerning. Yeah. And where would you go with that?
Yeah. John, I hear you. Dr. Holder, what can you share with John, a 20-year-old daughter, long hauler with COVID, who's about to get her first vaccination?
Yeah, I'm sorry about your daughter and what has happened. And uncertainty in medicine, especially with a novel infection. I mean, no one in this world has ever seen this infection before. So we are slowly gathering information. And what science tried to avoid is giving preliminary data, and then it shows up to be wrong later. And that has happened before with this coronavirus. So we are hearing more people holding back and waiting till real definitive data to say yes or no. But getting the vaccine post-infection is absolutely necessary to boost your immune system to be able to fight off another infection, whether it's another variant that shows up.
Sandy B. wrote us in an email, Dr. Holder, that she had COVID in August. She got the monoclonal antibodies. She had gotten two doses of the Pfizer vaccine in January, but had a breakthrough case. Her main question is, can she get a flu shot after getting COVID?
Oh, absolutely. We are recommended flu vaccines, and there's no interaction with any of the other vaccines and the coronavirus vaccine, nor is there a problem with having the infection of coronavirus with COVID-19 and the flu vaccine. So get your flu vaccine, and you're also eligible for your booster within the next few months.
I'll ask a question from the Hudson household. My own mother asked me, can I get my flu vaccine and a booster at the same time?
The guidance hasn't come out as yet, but they're looking to do just that. They're even looking to combine it in one vaccine.
Hmm.
So we know that would help decrease the amount of time between vaccines and more convenient for the community. So absolutely, that's where we're going. This is another example of not having the full guidance yet. So we're waiting on that.
Yeah, yeah. And that can be hard in normal times and awfully difficult during these pandemic times. Dr. Cheryl Holder is with us, FIU College of Medicine. Dr. Holder, we're going to be short on time here, but I'm going to get to as many questions as I can, including the question about livestock medicine, horse medicine, as a potential treatment for COVID-19. What are you saying to your patients?
No. Now, like all these misinformation, it starts off with a little bit of fact. They have looked at that drug back in Australia, back in the early pandemic, to see does it work or not. And the data has not shown effectiveness. There was one small study that showed possibility, but it didn't pan out. So we're knowing the side effects are tremendous. The vaccine works. Get the vaccine. You will decrease your risk of severe and hospitalization.
Dr. Holder, a clear answer there. No to the horse medicine. Cheryl Holder, FIU College of Medicine Associate Professor. Always a pleasure, Dr. Holder. Thank you for spending your time with us.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Terrence Shepard, our news director. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Peter J. Meritz, our technical supervisor. Richard Ives answers the phones. And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.